From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, is Dan Gilbert poaching Oakland County companies to fill his downtown Detroit buildings? That's what Team Oakland thinks.
It's like, why are you even doing that? Why are you coming to the suburbs to recruit these companies when let's work together and go recruit companies outside?
We meet bluegrass duo Don Julin and Billy Strings. After building a following in Northwest Michigan, they're taking their music around the state.
You know, this music really comes from the ground, man. It comes from my heart and stuff. And I think to really learn it, you really have to just learn the music. You can't learn the numbers and letters, man. You got to learn the feeling.
And diaries from days gone by show a much different kind of Christmas in Michigan.
One man itemized what he had spent for Christmas in the 1860s. The total was $1.70.
Those stories and more today. Is Detroit businessman Dan Gilbert poaching Oakland County companies to fill his downtown Detroit buildings?
It's like, why are you even doing that? Why are you coming to the suburbs to recruit these companies when let's work together and go recruit companies outside?
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, saber-rattling north and south of 8 Mile Road. But first, Governor Snyder and legislative leaders have struck a deal on road funding. After many, many closed-door meetings, the announcement was made a short time ago at a news conference at the Capitol. To get to more than $1 billion in funding, the centerpiece of this plan is a boost in the state sales tax, and that's something voters would have to decide on in a ballot question in May. Governor Snyder says that's okay with him.
The challenging part is it requires a ballot proposal, which is more work. But isn't it good that we ask our citizens to participate in this process in a constructive way?
Joining me now, the co-hosts of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics, Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark. Big time to talk, you two.
Big news out of the Capitol today.
Rick, give us the details of this plan. A lot of moving parts.
Oh, sure. A lot of moving parts. And as you pointed out, the centerpiece is this ballot question that would go on the ballot in May, that it would raise the sales tax by a percentage point from 6% to 7%. And that's basically the underpinning of the financial structure. And if voters don't approve it, this is an all or nothing bet. If voters don't approve it, then everything crumbles and they would have to start all over again.
Ugh.
Some of the other details would be that the sales tax on fuel sales would be phased out so that money would all go to road funding, and the current tax, which is basically it's just a number of cents on the dollar that's set by the legislature, would become a percentage tax. There would be some changes in registration fees that would account for almost $100 million, and half of that would be paid by heavy trucks. And like I said, voters have to say yes to this in May or it all falls to pieces.
Well, Zoe, what is the likelihood voters are going to do that and say yes to this in May?
That is the, let's say, the $1.2 billion question, Cindy. I mean, you know, this is what it's all coming down to. And in fact, when Senate Minority Leader Gretchen Whitmer was asked about that at the Capitol today during this press conference, when they're all standing up there explaining this deal, she said she didn't even want to think mm-hmm. about what would happen if voters reject this. And interestingly enough, one of the things that I think we're going to be watching for, Cindy, is how bad this winter is. You know, this mm-hmm. was such a big issue for lawmakers in February and March, and then it got warm out, and then there were other issues. So I really, as much as there are going to be both sides, you know, some pushing for this, against it, I think Mother Nature may have just as much of a lobbying effort in this than anything else come May.
That's true. And Governor Snyder and a lot of Democrats in particular, you know, would have preferred to have this be an either or, that there'd be a guaranteed source of funding for
Absolutely.
The roads, you know, sort of like what we saw back in the 90s with Proposal A and school
Absolutely.
Funding. If you approve the sales tax, then it's paid for this way, but otherwise it's paid for this way. And that was just not to be.
Well, Republicans, of course, we know, are in charge in Lansing, but
yep.
they need the Democrats to get on board to get this passed. So what are the Dems
because
getting
there
in
aren't
this
enough Republicans who will support it.
There you go. So what are the Democrats getting in this deal, Rick?
You know, Democrats are opposed to the sales tax, you know, in principle, because it's a regressive tax, because it's a percentage that it's a higher portion of the income of low and middle class people than wealthier people. And so what they got out of this is a restoration of the state's earned income tax credit to what it was when Rick Snyder took office. Another thing that chagrined them during the past 4 years was taking money out of the school aid fund and using it to fund universities. Now that money can only be used for K-12 schools. It could also be used for community colleges and technical education, which of course are you know, really just woven into the fabric of K-12 education right now.
And when you actually look at the numbers, I mean, some of this, I mean, these are big numbers, I would say, for Democrats, mm-hmm. what they got out of it. $300 million additional dollars mm-hmm. to schools. That adds up to about $200 per pupil.
And they say the earned income tax credit, a total of $260 million, would actually be, to use the phrase, net tax relief for low-income families that would still be paying the higher sales tax.
Mm-hmm. So Democrats definitely getting something out of this.
So Zoe, why now? This has been talked about for months and months and months. Some kind of deal has to happen.
And here we
what
are.
Happened timing-wise? It made it happen
because
today.
Much like we like to talk about lawmakers in D.C. right now, Lansing is sort of governing out of crisis, and that crisis is the fact that lame duck. After today, it's mm-hmm. over. This is the last day that they've scheduled before everyone goes home for the holidays. So this was just an issue of timing. And obviously, though, it worked. I mean, we saw all this week in and out of offices, food being brought into the offices, boxes of pizza around these offices, these, you know, sessions. It felt probably a little bit like, you know, college campus around, you know, around finals time. But I think there was an indication that they needed to get something done, that they couldn't leave Lansing without getting something done. And if they did, there would be some interesting
repercussions.
Exactly.
Well, remember, three of the four leaders here are legislative leaders, are not going to be there in the coming mm-hmm. session. And I think there was just a sense that if they came out with nothing on road funding, that the failure would just be too great. But they had to work it. You know, that they wheeled a whiteboard into the governor's office in the state capitol, and they wrote out what all their big principles were that they wanted to follow, and they had to check them off to get to this particular point. And putting it on the ballot was the only way to satisfy everything that was essential to everyone in the room.
And let's remember, this goes to the ballot. There is going to be lobbying for this. There's going to be campaigning for this. So for the governor, this is not over. See him come springtime. He's going to have to take some ownership of it and push this and try to get voters to vote on it come May. Well, so it's not mm-hmm. not quite over yet.
He did say it was a big priority of his second term.
And getting it done now.
Yeah. It was a big priority of his first term. Now it's been kicked into his second term.
Exactly. The hosts of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Always fun to talk with Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Cindy.
Always a pleasure.
Go for the ambiance, go for the free eggnog, and oh yeah, go for a Christmas tree. At Flat Snoot's Christmas Tree in Ann Arbor, visiting owner Duke Wagatha is all part of the experience of finding the perfect evergreen.
Do you want me
it's this one. It's this one.
Yeah. Yes, it's this one. It's tall and not very big around, and it's got good branches. Yeah. What do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this is the one?
And it has a big old space up there for the star.
It sure does.
My name is Duke Wagatha. I own this place. I started this 34 years ago in Ann Arbor, and we've been having fun with it ever since.
How are you guys tonight?
Good.
Good, good. You find something good out there?
Yeah.
All right. Did you get a vote on your tree?
Oh, yeah. He pretty much picked it out.
All right. You get like a double vote, right?
Yes.
We all live, or most of the guys here live in Mesa, Michigan, and that's just south of Traverse City. It's 220 miles from my doorstep here to my doorstep at home. We call this tree camp. It's kind of like deer camp, except we're selling trees instead of shooting deer. We rotate the guys through the trailer, but somebody's always staying here, 24/7.
Cool. What'd you get there, Theron?
Erasers, stickers, and a pencil.
Very excited about that part.
That's a good pencil to write Santa Claus a letter.
Yeah, that's right. You haven't done that yet.
There's two ways to do it. You know, you can write Santa and tell him what you want, or if you want to save him time, you can write and tell him what you don't want.
Yeah.
The trailer is part of the whole deal. It's a 1951 Vagabond. So 63 years old, and it's got that old style, almost looks like a Pullman train car. And so that's part of the draw. What's it like to live in this tin can? Well, You got to respect each other's space pretty well. I mean, we cook in here. We do everything here. We do the trailer two-step to get by each other. Young man, do you like eggnog?
Yeah.
All right.
Talking about the eggnog.
Eggnog? All right, good.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. There's actually lots of kids that come in here that have never tried it. That amazes me. Because that was such a big deal growing up for me.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah, me too.
How did she know what we did?
How could kids never try eggnog if it's so good?
I know. We sell right up till Christmas Eve afternoon. And then we all pack up, get home for Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, spend a couple days up north. And we usually come down the 27th or 28th, I kind of forget. And it takes us 2 to 3 days to tear down. But one wonderful thing is when we come back from Christmas, there's almost always money stuffed in the door. And we always spend that money very wisely. We hit the bar, have burgers and beer. So we put it to good use. Cheers to a peaceful and prosperous New Year.
Oh, I love it.
I hope you get lots of loot from Santa.
Yeah.
All right, man.
All right.
You've been a good boy,
too.
Right? No fooling? No fooling?
Yeah.
No. I believe you. All right. Merry Christmas.
Cheers.
Stateside's Rebecca Kruth brought us that audio postcard.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you're dashing around right now trying to knock items off of your holiday to-do list, it might be time to take a moment and think back to a time when a bowl of oyster stew was your Christmas dinner and a $1.75 pair of gloves took care of your gift-giving. Michigan historians Priscilla and Larry B. Massey of Allegan are here now. Among their books, Walnut Pickles and Watermelon Cake, A Century of Michigan Cooking, written together. And Larry is the author of 21 books. His latest is Blue Water, Red Metal, and Green Gold, The Color of Michigan's Past. Priscilla and Larry, it's very good to have you with us today.
Very happy to be here, Cynthia.
Thank you.
Larry, your book, Pioneer Diaries, has a whimsical chapter about Christmas titled 19th Century Michigan Christmas, Bah Humbug. Why were early Michiganders so bah humbug about Christmas?
Well, you know, I looked at these diaries. They got a collection of them at the Western Michigan University Archives. Hundreds of diaries kept by just ordinary people. And I looked at what was happening on Christmas Eve and Christmas through the years, starting in the 1830s up to the 1880s. And what I found before the Civil War was that Christmas was not being celebrated. It was just another day. People went down to the store and did shopping. They went and paid their taxes. They went to the post office and mailed letters. The post office is open. Just hardly any mention at all of Christmas. And what I think the reason for that was, Michigan was settled by New Englanders, or those the sons and daughters of New Englanders who had moved to Western New York in the 1820s, then came on into Michigan, and they brought with them traditions that were common in New England, which was, you know, it was not a good thing to celebrate Christmas, the Puritan tradition. It was even against the law in Massachusetts until 1856 to celebrate Christmas. So they brought this tradition with them and kept it up.
Did you notice in these diaries at all, Larry, did anybody, you know, throw a gift somebody's way?
Well, what happens is around the Civil War time, you start to see Christmas creep into the diaries in a very austere way. One man itemized what he had spent for Christmas in the 1860s, and the total was $1.70, and the 70 cents included a gallon of oysters. But he bought one present. He bought a thimble for his wife for 50 cents. And so, you know, in other words, here's a thimble, honey. Keep sewing. Merry Christmas.
But why did things begin to take a turn to the more festive as we went through and past the Civil War?
Well, we start to get different ethnic people coming into Michigan, the Dutch and the Germans and people like that, the Danish. And they brought with them their own traditions of celebrating Christmas. And then during the Civil War, a lot of the troops came back from the South. Down South, they celebrated Christmas in a festive way. And they came back with these ideas of, hey, this is not so bad. This is fun. And so you see it creeping in, although you don't find people putting up Christmas trees in their own homes. They might have a communal Christmas tree down at the church. And everybody would go down on Christmas Eve and get a present from the church. of course, back then there was no electricity, so whatever illumination was candles. And they put little candles, a little bit bigger than a birthday candle, on the tree. And so the whole ceremony would take 15, 20 minutes, and then the candles would burn out.
And you'd have to go home.
Right.
Priscilla, did that mean that Christmas dinner actually began to be a thing, as Larry described, as things got more festive after the Civil War? Did dinners reflect that?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And these... The dinners started out being a lot of people wrote about having oysters for Christmas dinner, which really surprised me, and because you don't really see it around now. It didn't go through all the generations, but I think because of the pioneers that came from out east, they had the oysters. But the people would really show off their baking. The women would, you know, they'd already have things. They'd have things in their pantry, and they'd have things in their root cellar. But that was the time to show off their baking. And the Swedes would make their braided Irish bread, or, you know, the rye breads. And the Irish had their soda breads with the cross on it, of course. And the French would be making their chocolate custards or cream puffs. So those would come out that day, and all the families would get together.
What might surprise or perhaps even appall us today that might have been on the table for, let's say, a Michigan Christmas dinner in the 1870s?
Well, there definitely would have been the fresh oysters. Yeah. The oysters would have been used in many different ways, and they, you know, sometimes they cooked them, but most of the time they liked them just on ice. But they might have them oyster fritters or something like that on that day. They would have had passenger pigeon. There was any kind of wild game they would have had if that was available. And of course, their pigs and their chickens. But you know, they were basic eaters. What was around, what is fresh and what is popular now, is what was going on back then. So if they had dried apples, they were making stuffing maybe with dried apples, or the English would have their beef and Yorkshire pudding. But they'd also have their pickled things, like in their pantries.
Yes.
And they pickled everything, Cynthia. Everything from pumpkins to peaches to fish. You know, maybe they went and they had a smelt run, and they would can that up, the smelt, and they could open that up later on.
Well, they had to. They didn't have a freezer to throw it in, did they?
That's right. They had nothing. So, and it was one of those where they got up at 4 in the morning or 5 in the morning, and one of the sons, if they were lucky, would go out and chop the wood and help mom get the wood stove going, and because there weren't electric stoves. And the whole thing would be getting that oven hot, getting it even, because you have to have it a couple hours going before you can do your baking.
As far as gifts, it's interesting. You know, you talk about, here, honey, here's a thimble.
Yeah.
My mother grew up on a farm in Guelph, Ontario, so not especially far from here, maybe 4 hours drive from the southeast Michigan area.
Uh-huh.
And I know she talked about how happy they were to get an orange on Christmas morning,
yeah,
maybe a little doll, very much like the kind of things you'd read about in the Laura Ingalls Wilder Little House book. So was that pretty typical for especially these farm families in the late 19th
yeah
and early 20th century?
If they do mention gifts, it's very utilitarian. A boy might get a jackknife or a pair of gloves or something like that. Although I did find one mention in the 1880s of a woman that found a silk dress in her stocking, which would be kind of difficult to cram in, but she was excited about it.
What do you think, Larry, do you think those early Michiganders would think and say if they could see what we do for Christmas in 2014?
They wouldn't be able to believe it, I don't think, because it's so festive and everybody's out shopping, and starting with Thanksgiving, everybody's out shopping and spending a lot of money. And they didn't have a lot of money to spend, for one thing. Somebody might go out and work a full 12 hours and make 75 cents back then.
It was a lot of homemade.
There was a lot of homemade things. They would frame mottos, for example, and give them to their children, religious-type mottos.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they'd recognize Christmas at all.
Larry B. Massey and Priscilla Massey, Michigan historians and authors. Larry's latest book is Blue Water, Red Metal, and Green Gold, The Color of Michigan's Past. Thank you both for getting us in the holiday mood.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Thank you.
If you haven't heard of Don Julin and Billy Strings, you probably haven't been hanging around Traverse City. But not to worry. The bluegrass duo that's made a name for themselves in Northwest Michigan are giving you plenty of chances to hear their music. As Stateside's Emily Fox learned, they'll be touring the state over the next couple of months.
I ain't gonna work tomorrow. I ain't gonna work today. ain't going to work tomorrow, for that is my wedding day.
That's Billy String singing there and playing guitar. He's also joined by his bandmate Don Julin on mandolin. Billy and Don have joined us from Interlochen Public Radio Studios. Now, Billy and Don, I have to mention the age difference between you guys. Billy, you are 22. Don, you are 54. Does that age difference ever create tension when it comes to touring, playing, or other things related to the duo?
Yeah, but it's all good. We get along.
I think we balance each other out. Don is, you know, Don is strictly business. Don is, you know, we finish the gig, and I run off and go party with my friends while he takes care of the business and gets us paid. And so my feathers are fluffed, you know. I'm a 22-year-old kid. I want to rock and roll and party. But Don has, you know, he's done all that. So he's just, you know, we kind of mellow each other out. He keeps me in the reins, and I make sure he has a little fun.
And Don, how do you feel about all that?
Oh, that's pretty accurate. Yeah, I mean, we have a lot in common. Obviously, with 30-some years between us, we're at different stages in our life journey. So I don't know if when I was 22, I don't think mine was much different than what Billy's is right now. But
maybe when I'm 54, I'll...
Right, when I'm 54.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your musical backgrounds. Don, you play mandolin for the band, and you studied music, arranging, composing, film scoring, and have written two instructional books on mandolin, and you also have traveled the world teaching workshops on the mandolin. So, Don, tell us about when the mandolin became a big part of your life.
Well, I was introduced to it shortly out of high school. I guess I was 19, and I started playing mandolin, and I think that's when my musical journey really started. That's when I realized that I might be able to make a career of this one way or the other. And here it is 35 years later, and I'm still trying to make a career of this one way or the other.
And meanwhile, Billy, you play guitar for the band, and you didn't study music. In fact, I understand you don't even read music, but I understand you were also a pretty rebellious kid. You got kicked out of school a few times, you have gauged ears, tattoos, and used to be in a heavy metal band. How did you get into bluegrass?
All that stuff came later. I started with bluegrass. You know, when I was born, I'm pretty sure I heard Ralph Stanley in the womb, but I started out, you know, when I was a young kid. I was about 6 and I got a guitar, and we were playing bluegrass. You know, my dad is a good bluegrass picker and singer, and he would have people over picking. And I was surrounded by fiddles and banjos, you know, as a kid. And then later on, I wanted to play music with my friends, with my peers, but none of my peers knew anything about bluegrass. They were playing this junk. And so I jumped in there with them, and I got me an electric guitar and started playing some of that. Different kinds of music and stuff, rock and roll, heavy metal, or whatever. But then I realized that bluegrass is where my heart is, so I just came back, and I came back strong.
So how does that work where, Don, you have this kind of classical education and background in music versus, Billy, you kind of can learn things by ear? How does that work out when you're learning music together or playing together?
Yeah, I can't read music. I don't know what key I'm in half the time. I just, I just play. I just play from my toes. I play from my heart. And I've just grown up with it. You know, where Don does too, just because Don can read music and does do all of that stuff, you know, he's just as good as a player, you know.
You still have to play by ear, playing certain types of music. If you play rock and roll, or if you play bluegrass, or if you play blues, it doesn't matter if you can read. Mm-hmm. You can't, nobody reads rock and roll, or you can't read blues.
You can't read soul.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What about bluegrass? Is there a history? I mean, I don't think that you would sit down and really read a sheet of music when you're
nope.
playing bluegrass.
Nope. You learn the tunes from, you know, your buddy at the festival while you're passing around a jar.
Yeah, you learn it by ear. It's and, you know, I think that's, to me, I think that's one of the coolest things about music is you can have people that come from different backgrounds or learn it differently. You can study music like I have, or you could play completely by ear like what Billy has. But if you're both interested in the same music, there's common ground. I mean, I'm not going to write down a bluegrass solo. I mean, I would for a student if they wanted to learn it, but I would still say that they should learn it off the recording versus the paper. Double check yourself with the paper. Get it in your head, get it under your fingers, and then look at the paper and go, do I have it right? Is that really what he wants me to do? But I don't know. Playing by ear is really super valuable.
Mm-hmm. To me, this music, bluegrass music, is there's tons of kids, they learn it all different ways, but to me, this music really comes from the ground, man. It comes from, like I said, my heart and stuff. And I think to really learn it, you really have to just learn the music. You can't learn the numbers and letters, man. You got to learn the feeling.
And I feel like it's also kind of a communal experience. Like people are sitting on their porch together, learning
absolutely
off of one another. Yeah.
I can get together with five dudes at a festival that I have never met before in my life. And we could play a tune and sound like a band that's rehearsed because we all know the same vocabulary and the same tunes. I learned tunes that I learned from my dad, who learned from my grandfather, who learned from who knows where,
Mm-hmm.
And it just gets passed down like that. And to me, that's a very special part of this music, just the organic factor of it.
The times have changed, the times have changed. Humanity has lost its way. The people now, how they survive, I don't know how.
That's Billy Strings. He and Don Julin are a bluegrass duo out of Traverse City. And you guys are doing a lot of touring across the state through the end of February. Are you able to make a living solely off of your music right now?
Yeah. Don's been making his way around with just his mandolin for longer than I've been alive. Like you mentioned earlier, he's an author. He's done everything there is to do with music, But me, I just, I had a hotel job for a while, but I was able to quit that. And so for 2.5 years, I've been making my living off of music, and it feels very good to be able to just work on what I, what I want to do, and not have to come home after my 9-to-5 and then practice. I get to wake up in the morning and then practice all day and then go to a gig and practice some more.
And that's pretty cool that you're only 22 and already making a living just doing music. What is that like, though? And Don, please feel free to jump in. What is the enjoyment and the fun of touring versus the stress of kind of, having to hustle sometime? What is that ratio like for you guys?
It's worth it. To me, it's I'm the luckiest boy I know that I get to play music. I play music whether I'm sick or sad or tired or cold or warm. I love playing music, so if I'm not out there gigging, I'm at home playing, or somewhere picking. So it's like, I really love the music, and playing on stage isn't my job. That's more like the benefits, I love doing that, but it's all the traveling and all the driving, and I'm a truck driver. That's what I do for a living.
But what do you think is the key to being successful, being a Michigan-based, band or duo or a musician?
I don't know if it's Michigan-based or anything. I think the biggest thing that most artists struggle with is the business end of the art that they're trying to do. Whether they're a painter or they're a poet or they're a musician, they're normally so into the art that they don't, sometimes they even say, I don't care about money. Well, talk to me when your landlord comes around on the first of the month. It's really handy to have money for rent and have money for food and be able to do your art. And maybe that's the 30-some years of experience speaking, because I've really, really tried to avoid a daytime job for 30-some years and have been pretty successful at it. But there's a lot of elements. There's performing, there's teaching, there's selling CDs. There's licensing songs for films or video. There's, all that kind of stuff all ties into... if you want to make a living as an artist, you need to learn all the ways that your art can generate money and decide which one of those ways you feel good about. Sometimes there's certain things people might say, well, that's a sellout, I'm not going to do that. Well, that's an artistic choice. That's totally cool. But I think, if you can, many successful artists end up bringing a business manager into their team, someone who can make money for the artist. I think we're lucky enough that at the level we're at right now, we've been able to get that far on our own.
Well, I've been speaking with Traverse City-based bluegrass duo Billy Strings and Don Julin. They'll be playing across the state through the end of February. A full schedule of the tour can be found at billystrings.com. Billy and Don, thanks for joining us on Stateside.
Thanks so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. With a road funding deal in the works today at the Capitol, Governor Snyder seems to be finishing up his year. But Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is here with an intriguing question. Where will Governor Rick Snyder find his second term mojo?
You know, you look at what this governor and his team have done in the first term, and it's pretty remarkable, whether starting obviously most recently with the Detroit bankruptcy getting done quicker and a lot less ugly than a lot of people expected, business tax reforms done, budgeting is now done in a timely manner, and there isn't all this sturm and drang about shutdowns. Debt is being paid down. Public pensions are being funded at the state level and in local school districts because of some of the funding that they've done at and how they've directed some of the funding. These are some kind of big things. And of course, there was a right to work and that was signed in 2012, which really is, as I put it, an act of political dissonance. I mean, this is a state that has gone blue pretty regularly for the last 20 years in presidential elections, and yet it's become a right to work state. So you look at this and you say, okay, Governor, and I've asked him this, what are you going to do in the second term? And to hear him talk about it, job training and more financial accountability in local schools and local government, it's kind of a yawner. But the thing that I think is very motivating potentially for him and could be emphatically make a statement is trying to get his arms and the state's arms around its obligation to educate Detroit's children. It's often overlooked that the state has that obligation. It's laid out in the state constitution.
That's a good point. And now that we've got Kevin Orr's packed up and gone home to Maryland and the Detroit bankruptcy is in the rearview mirror, you think it's time to really hone in on the schools?
Well, I think there's a general feeling of that. There's a recent coalition that came together of community people and business leaders and political leaders to try and look at how to get their arms around the school problem in Detroit. And that's not just DPS, which is clearly a mess. But it's also charter schools. It's a lot of different disparate things that are kind of working at cross purposes. And I think that everybody recognizes that the system is broken. And it's important to note here that as successful as emergency management may have appeared to have been in restructuring Detroit's financials, it has been pretty much, I think, agreed across the board an utter failure when it comes to Detroit public schools. There have been emergency managers in and out of Detroit public schools going back to the late Engler years, and I don't think anybody would tell you that it's been a success. The governor himself in the last couple of weeks in his year-end interviews as he makes the rounds with all of us has acknowledged that and said, you know, I believe that emergency management is a system that needs to be done quickly, effectively, and you get out. And that has not happened in Detroit public schools. Part of it is the way in which schools are funded, obviously, that the funding comes with headcount of kids. And if you can't get your arms around the educational safety and cultural issues in the schools, people are going to vote with their feet. And when they vote with their feet, the funding goes with them.
Yeah.
Whether it goes to a charter school in the city or it goes to a parochial school in the city or it goes to a suburban school as the parents try to move out. There's a lot of different options, but the bottom line is the revenue is gone.
Yeah, but looking ahead into this next term, we're going to have a different makeup of a legislature.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And you're going to have, and I think the governor recognizes this. I mean, he says he knows the incoming Senate Majority Leader. He confesses to not knowing the incoming Speaker that well. And that's going to be a relationship he's going to have to work on. But I think it's his general consensus is that this Republican-controlled legislature starting in January is going to be more conservative than the one that is finishing up the lame duck as we speak. That being the case, I think there's going to be some things that are going to be more difficult for this governor to operate a little bit in that environment. He's not, by disposition, a really conservative, Tea Party-leaning kind of Republican. I don't think anybody would suggest that he is. And he's going to have to work through this. And he's also going to have to be dealing with, frankly, continuing questions about what role, if any, he's going to play in the 2016 presidential race. Is he actually considering doing that? I think most people who know him well and his wife well don't think that that's really viable. Or is he going to try it so he can highlight some of these issues like dysfunction in Washington and how to bring kind of responsible financial management to Washington like he believes and a lot of people believe he's brought to Lansing? I don't know that that's going to happen, but I think that's going to complicate a little bit his second term.
What do you see, Daniel, as the key to a strong second term for Rick Snyder?
Well, one of the things that he said to me, and I think you see it in the way he operates, is he wants to try and embed some of the reforms. you know, you can't ever make these things indelible, that they'll never go away. But I think he wants to push deeper into making the state more competitive and getting that message out. I mean, he makes the point, and I think we would all agree, that perceptions often lag reality when it comes to states and cities and auto industries and auto companies and things like that. And there's a real story to be told about what's going on here in Michigan, and we've talked about it a lot on your air over the last 18 months of, you know, what's happened in Detroit, the very unique confluence of people and events that have come together in the Detroit bankruptcy. And I think he's going to continue to push that. I also think he's a guy who wants to solve problems. I think that's kind of what he sees himself as, is a problem solver. And I think that as you look out on the landscape today, you know, you really can't say you've really dealt with the Detroit issue unless you start to get education in the schools and the schools on the right track. You're not going to fix it overnight, but you got to get things on the right track.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel House. Thanks so much, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Sand throwing between Oakland County's feisty executive L. Brooks Patterson and Dan Gilbert, who's arguably Detroit's number one booster, both in terms of buying buildings and enticing companies to move to downtown Detroit. Patterson took a poke at Gilbert, saying he'd be more impressed with Gilbert's job-creating offer efforts if he, in Patterson's word, brought in high-tech companies from Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, rather than looking through the fertile vineyards of Oakland County. Gilbert fired back with a statement saying, "We'd all do better if we could work together to grow the region and the state." Irene Spanos is director of the Department of Economic Development and Community Affairs for Oakland County. Hello.
Hello.
Good to have you.
Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure to have you on. And Bruce Katz is with us. He's VP and director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institute. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Irene, can you give us an idea of how much poaching Oakland County has experienced? I guess I'm wondering what triggered Brooks Patterson's comments about fighting to keep tech jobs in Oakland County?
Yes. Actually, we hear from our companies directly that they are being approached by the Gilbert Foundation and the Gilbert team down there to locate in the city of Detroit. And the only reason we find out about it is because the companies call us directly and say, "Hey, I've just been recruited downtown. I want to stay here. Can you help me stay here?" And so that's where Mr. Patterson's comments come from. It's like, why don't we work together and bring companies from outside of Michigan to help the region grow, as opposed to moving them from the suburbs down to the city, which has no net value to the region.
So, for instance, we saw Fifth Third Bank said it's moving its headquarters from Southfield to Dan Gilbert's One Woodward building right there at Woodward and Jefferson. And Bruce Katz, it might be tempting to say to Brooks Patterson, "Cry me a river," when one thinks of the flood of businesses and companies that left Detroit and moved to places in Oakland County like Troy and Southfield. Would some certain lack of sympathy be fair, do you think?
Well, we can all look back and think about the decentralization of jobs and people, which has happened obviously in Greater Detroit for quite some time, and the role of the counties in making that happen. I think the broader issue here, though, are cities and suburbs are completely interdependent. When the world looks at Greater Detroit, they don't really differentiate,
agreed,
for the most part, between the city, Macomb County, Oakland County, Wayne County. They see Greater Detroit. I mean, you really have sort of one brand that you're selling to the world, and to the greatest extent possible, particularly because we have a national government that's fairly dysfunctional, cities and suburbs need to collaborate to compete. You know, we can look back at what's happened over the last 50 years. We could look at the sort of current movement of jobs and people across borders. But the most important thing is to build this broader network of corporate, civic, and political leaders that are working together for the good of the region.
Absolutely. And I totally agree with Bruce on that. And our county executive, as well as my team, we do work with the city of Detroit on many levels, from, you know, the legislative area to business development to entrepreneurship activities in the region. And we do work very closely together on multiple issues that help the region, you know, from the food industry to the IT industry to the tech industry to retail and entrepreneurship. As a region, we all work together in Southeast Michigan, and we have been working together for a long time.
But one might say that Mr. Patterson's comments weren't indicative of exactly working together. It sounded like some saber rattling.
Well, In those particular instances where the companies have come to us and they've explained to us the exact meeting that Mr. Gilbert has had with the companies, I mean, of course, it's like, why are you even doing that? Why are you coming to the suburbs to recruit these companies when let's work together and go recruit companies outside? From Oakland County, we have over 1,000 foreign-owned firms from 38 different countries. And Brooks, for a long time, Mr. Patterson has always said, you know, do not poach from our neighbors. Let's add to the region. And even before I became director, when I was a business development rep working on business attraction for the European market, that was very clear to us in my entire department saying, we do not poach from Detroit. We do not poach from Macomb. We do not poach from Washtenaw. We go outside of the state of Michigan or outside of the U.S. to bring companies here. And so,
I grant that that's what you're working under now. And I guess hearkening back, looking at history, though, one would have to say that even if it wasn't active poaching, there was a flood of businesses and companies that left Detroit and landed north of 8 Mile in
Oakland
County.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. But those circumstances were, I don't think, proactive in us in the suburbs reaching out to those companies. I think they were looking to leave because they weren't finding what they needed in the city. And we're happy that the city is coming back now, and we want to be a part of that, absolutely. And I guess our point is, you know, if you're in Troy or Warren or Plymouth or Livonia, you are part of the Detroit comeback. You are part of the region. You don't need to necessarily be in the city of Detroit to be part of the comeback. And that's, I think, our message that we want to explain. And we want to work with Dan Gilbert's people to bring new businesses and help grow new entrepreneur activities. I mean, Mr. Patterson has extended our SBA loan program to outside of the county borders. And we're doing deals now in Detroit and throughout Wayne County and Macomb County, too. So those type of initiatives show that we do work together, I think.
Bruce, are other states seeing this type of, if we'll call this tension surrounding tech and other up-and-coming industries and movement from suburbs back into cities?
I think there are some very big demographic and economic forces that are compelling companies to rethink their locations. You know, in the economic sphere, the shift from a closed innovation model where companies would invent discoveries for the market within the firm to an open innovation model where companies are working with researchers or other companies to basically commercialize ideas. That's a huge shift, and it tends to demand and even crave proximity and density, which you can find either in a city or in many suburban municipalities. The other shift is demographic transformation. We are seeing a subsection or segment of the American population, let's say millennials, just to choose one, that are beginning to say, we want to live in a place, quality amenities, with access to transit, biking, walking, choice in transportation, that is authentic, even gritty at times. There is a rebalancing in the U.S. going on because not just a policy, public policy or private sector, you know, what Dan Gilbert may or may not be doing, but really because of big demographic and market forces. And we do see particularly growth around anchor institutions or advanced research institutions, medical campuses. So think MIT in Cambridge or Drexel in University City, Philly, or Georgia Tech in Atlanta. I think you're beginning to see the growth around Wayne State, Henry Ford Health, Detroit Medical Campus, College for Creative Studies, in addition to the downtown, because of these big demographic and economic shifts.
I think that word rebalancing really is a good one, in a sense. Does that seem like an apt phrase to use to you, Irene?
Rebalancing? Well, I think there's always a rebalancing happening, and I agree with some of the stuff that Bruce was talking about certain people, certain businesses, they want to be in that environment, but there'll always be businesses that don't want that environment, that don't want, you know, the parking issues, that don't want the hour-and-a-half commute drive. And I think there's enough out there in the world that we can all be successful. We had a company that had moved to Detroit and then moved back out to the suburbs, and the main reason was, you know, it was traffic was becoming bad. There was, we're hearing a few more of these, that it was good at one point of their business growth, but at a different point of their business growth, it made sense for these particular companies to come back to the suburbs. And I think it's just a matter of where your customers are, where your business connections are, where you get the most support. And if your customer is, you know, in the community next to you and you want to be close to that customer, you're going to be there. So I think a lot of the decision of where to locate comes from a personal business and a cultural point from within the organizations.
I wondered your thoughts on Dan Gilbert's response to Brooks Patterson basically saying, hey, let's all work together to grow the region and the state. And Irene, you seem to indicate that that's on the agenda for you. I'm just wondering more deeply.
Absolutely. And it has been. I mean, with from the Cobo deal to the Mayor Duggan. I mean, Mr. Patterson was born in the city of Detroit, did all of his education in the city of Detroit, got his law degree from the city of Detroit. He has a personal vested interest in the city of Detroit, and as we all do. I mean, it's our major city. We want Detroit to be revitalized. We want it to be a cool town, because you're right, Bruce. As we go outside of the world and we try to attract companies here, we sell Detroit, we sell the region, we sell the state.
So going forward, since both of these very dynamic, very strong personalities have kind of put this out here, what do you want to see happen next? What should happen next, Bruce Katz?
First, I think you need a unified narrative for the future economy. I mean, Greater Detroit, Southeast Michigan, is very, very strong on the fundamentals. I mean, when you think about this post-recession economy, what it's valuing is science, technology, engineering, and math, the STEM economy. And Southeast Michigan, in part because automobiles are computers on wheels, mm-hmm. it's not the only tech economy you have, but it's a big portion of it, mm-hmm. you score very well by national and international metrics. And so you've got a great thing to sell, and you've got a very distinctive offer to make. And I think, when all is said and done, what matters to the growth of a regional economy are four things: innovation, infrastructure, skills of your workforce, and the quality of your places. And I think there's an enormous potential, and as Irene has said, there's been examples of collaboration on all four of those things. So I think this is a time for Southeast Michigan post-bankruptcy, and where for the first time in decades, we're seeing a market momentum in the city for Southeast Michigan to realize its full potential, and for both private, civic, and political leaders to come together to make the kind of future investments in those four drivers.
Irene, you get the last thoughts.
I agree totally with Bruce. I think Southeast Michigan and the Metro Detroit region of the city and the suburbs, we have a bright future ahead of us, and this is the best time to be in the area in decades, as Bruce said. So I totally agree.
Irene Spanos, Director of the Department of Economic Development and Community Affairs for Oakland County, and she was joined by Bruce Katz, who's VP and Director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institute. So good to have both of you with us on Stateside. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having me.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.